Well, we're going to be back talking about the government today, everyone's favorite topic, right? No, not really, but if you're with us last week, you know this is not out of the blue. We're in Acts chapter 5 and verse 29. You don't have to open there specifically because we're going to be doing lots of flipping again today. But the apostles were standing before the Sanhedrin and said, we must obey God rather than man. And so last week we began talking about that phrase, talking about how God across the scriptures authorizes governments, whether it be the kind that we like or the kind we disagree with, whether it be good or evil, all authority exists because God has put it in place. The scriptures make a powerful and consistent testimony that God not only authorizes human institutions, but the only reason they actually have any power is because God determined it to be so. All right, so that's where we left off last week, and where Paul gives us very clear teaching in Romans chapter 13 last week was this, is that to go against them is to go against the God who authorizes and empowers them. And that's a troubling thing for us to ponder. And yet, we come to a text like Acts chapter 5, verse 29, where the apostles say, we ought to or we must, depending on your translation, we ought to or must obey God rather than man. So how do we make sense of the two? All right, so that's where we're going to venture again here to consider this. I would tell you this from the very get-go, like I left off telling you last week, and that is this, that obeying God, that's the goal of every Christian's heart, right? A God-fearing person desires to obey God more than anything else. Obeying God generally means cooperating with and obeying the decrees of the government, whether you like it or not. Generally, that's the way that it works, because to go against them, according to what the scripture teaches, is not only to invite wrath from the king and from God himself, and also it does harm to the conscience. And if you check out on me for the rest of the time, and I hope you won't, I hope you at least hear this. If you walk in consistent sin, it will warp you. It will warp your conscience. Okay? And this is one of those areas where we think about like, oh yes, pastor, we know that someone who's living in adultery or pornography or they're a constant thief or they're constantly lying and bearing false witness, of course that's going to change and corrupt them. Remember that sin is sin in God's eyes, right? If we live in consistent sin, something even as simple as utter and open rebellion of mind and heart and life towards the government, that has a compounding effect on our conscience. Because we're pushing against something that God has made in this world. Living in constant sin will warp you, and warp not only the way that you think and the way that you process things, but also warp your soul. As an example of this, I just read about a theologian this week who they always had questions about was he faithful to his spouse or not, and now there's this whole batch of letters that have come out. And this theologian for decades had an affair, where to the point he even invited his mistress, who was his assistant, to live with him and his wife. I mean, twisted stuff, okay? He actually wrote in the letters that he was so insistent that he believed that God wanted him to be happy so he could have both women. This is the kind of correspondence. And this man has written thousands of pages of what many consider to be very, very good theology, one of the best of the 19th century. And it's like, how is that possible? Right? And it's causing lots of people to ask lots of questions, because how could someone be so twisted in their soul and then write good theology, right? So this is part of the thing where this is not a something that's out there pie in the sky. Sin warps us and twists us. And it's not just sins like adultery or lying or deceit and those sense of things. If we push against the things that God has made, even things like governments, then we ought to be reminded of the fact that it has a compounding effect in here. So what we're going to talk about this morning with the time that we have is this, is when is there a greater moral obligation upon us to obey God rather than to obey man? Okay, last week we talked about the normal pattern of things, but there are some exceptional things, like the statement that the apostles and Peter made together saying we ought to or we must obey God rather than man. That's what we want to talk about here today. Now, here's one of the things. I would love to say, if like, oh, I have a perfect example from, you know, such and such a law on our books that would say, this is the time that all of you should rise up and stand against our government. But there's no laws like that yet, right? We're given options. We're told this is what you ought to do. But there's no commands as of yet. However, there's lots of opportunities in the scriptures for us to study some examples where they were commanded without any recourse to do things that were completely against what God had asked them to do or what he had commanded them to do in his word. So that's what we're going to primarily do, is look at some examples. Like, we could talk about fear-mongering all day long about this rule and that law and that proposition, but all of those things, still, we still have options as citizens and as people in this world. So the examples I picked are people living in God-fearing kingdoms that praise God, and they stand against the government when they have a moment of right. All right, so there are some places here we're going to look. So we're going to start in back way in the book of Exodus this morning. We're going to do a lot of flipping here, so you're just going to have to trek with me. You're not going to stay in one spot and camp there. I'm sorry. I guess you can stay in your seat, I suppose. Hope you don't leave, but that's to be determined, I guess, yet at this point. What I want you to do, though, as we look through these examples this morning, is this: I want you to note where they comply, and I want you to know where they draw their line. Because that is the ultimate question that we're really wrestling with in our own hearts, is where do we comply with the government that God's put over us, and where do we draw the line and say, enough is enough, I must obey God rather than man? That's the question, right? Is to where is it that we draw the line? And so I want you to notice here, as we work through some of these examples this morning, of where they drew the line and where they were willing to comply, and to how much they were willing to comply, because it gives us some fuel for thought here. God, we ask this morning as we look into your word, that you would help us to understand these things. And Lord, I pray that your spirit would speak through your word, and that your word would speak clearly, and it would make up for all of my deficiencies in communicating these things clearly. God, we want your word to reign supreme here, not only in our lives, but in our church and in our hearts. And so we ask for your help now for these moments we have left to consider this very relevant topic in our world, and ask that you'd give us wisdom and discernment from the things that you've revealed. And we ask this in your name. Amen. A couple of examples to start here. I've just got some outline up here. A couple of examples in Egypt. All right, so notice here first, we'll talk about some midwives. Start in Exodus chapter 1, and I'm going to start reading in verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Look at the children of Israel. They are more and they are mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And it happen in the event of war, they join our enemies and fight against us, so that they will go up out of the land." Therefore, they sent taskmasters over them to afflict them with burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and brick and all manner of service in the field. All their service which they made them serve was with rigor. Then, verse 15, the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom one's name was Shiphrah and the other's name was Puah, and he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and you see them on the birthstools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. If it is a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive?" Midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, for they are lively or vigorous, and they give birth before the midwives can come to them." Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them. All right, so I'm going to pause here and talk about this example for just a minute. The idea of Pharaoh was this: if I can't destroy them by hard bondage, if I can't control their population by hard bondage, by sorrow and misery, then what I will do is I'll start killing off all the boys. This is planned to control the people group, right? The remaining women would be dependent on their captors. There's less chance for a growing population. There's less chance, as it's noted here in the text, for an army to come out of this nation of slaves. And so, trying to act shrewdly, he intends to get rid of masculinity and the male gender in a large form across this people. And as I commented last week, the stripping away of masculinity and the male gender is still seen as a means of control in our world today. If you don't believe that, we can talk about that later. That's a whole other topic. These God-fearing midwives, though, we're told here, are asked to do something against their very training, against their very experience, against their very conscience, and that is this: if you see a baby being born, if it's a boy, kill it. That goes against everything that a midwife intends to do, right? This goes against not only their conscience, but everything that they have been doing. And I imagine it's the very same way in our world. We have many compassionate midwives and doulas and pediatric nurses and doctors that do delivery, right? There's all kinds of people that if you said to them, after they've trained and worked, especially after they've labored alongside of a mom who's going through the all, and you'd be like, "Oh, it's a boy, sorry. and then kill it. Can you imagine? It just goes against everything that's natural in our minds. Like, we all know that this is wrong, and yet they were asked to do this. Imagine going through a mom, helping her through this whole labor and delivery, and then just finding it's a boy and have to kill it. It's a sin against nature. It is a sin against things that we know to be right, just like many of the laws that are passed in our land today are against nature too, in this way. These women could not stand by and would not stand by and obey the command of the king. So what did they do? Well, they saved the lives of the male children. Now, we're not told specifically, did they attend to the births and then lie? Or did they just show up late to the birth? Well, they're really vigorous in childbirth. They had the babies before he got there. Oh, well, we're not really told. But the point here is that they were called to account for their actions in verse 17. They did what God wanted them to do. And when they were called to account in verse 18, God stood with them. Notice in verse 20 that God dealt well with them. And one of the interesting things about this statement in verse 21 that comes is this, is that not only did he protect them from Pharaoh, because Pharaoh could have been like, well, then kill all the midwives off and I'll do this myself. That didn't happen. And in fact, there's this little added comment on here that God provided households. That is, God gave children to the midwives. All right, there's this idea here that not only did he bless them by protecting them from Pharaoh because they stood up for what was right and they did what was right in the eyes of God rather than what man was commanding them to do, God also blessed them above and beyond because of their willingness. Their devotion to a higher law was something that was what was given here as being a good thing. Now you say, Pastor, they didn't even have the law to go off of yet. I know. Because this speaks to the law that God has put on every human being's heart. And I'm not talking about the new covenant law that's talked about later on. I'm talking about the fact that God has put a moral conscience in the heart of every single person. Right? The very idea of killing a baby is absolutely wrong. And everybody knows it in the back of their minds. You don't see little babies and you're like, oh, you're so cute, I'm going to kill you. Like, that's totally outside. Now, I understand people struggle with postpartum depression, things like that, but the natural inkling of a person's heart is not to see someone that is helpless and innocent and to destroy them. And these ladies knew that this was completely and totally wrong. It didn't matter what Pharaoh said because they knew what was right. They were God-fearers, and so they acted in what was right. This is a perfect example of when should a person obey God and disobey the government. Perfect example. Right? Want to think about. The next example comes right after it, because Pharaoh's idea is, okay, so bondage didn't kill them, the midwives are too slow or they're lying to me, he can't really figure out what's going on here, the babies are still being born, so I have a solution. If there's a baby and he's a boy, what should we do? You guys know. Chuck him in the river, right? Well, let's keep reading. So, verse 22, Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. And the man of the house of Levi went and took as his wife a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son, and she saw that he was a beautiful child. She hid him 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, laid it on the reeds by the river's bank. So his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked along the riverside, and she saw the ark among the reeds, and she sent her maid to get it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, this is one of those Hebrews' children. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse for you from among the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away, nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed him, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, because I drew him out of the water. The second example here of disobeying the government are Moses' parents. Moses' parents. The Pharaoh said, if you got a baby boy, chuck him in the river. Now, again, every parent here is thinking about this, like, how could I take my brand new baby and throw him into the river? And you're like, there's no way. So they did what they thought to be right. And that was for as long as they possibly could, as they looked upon this baby for 3 months, the text says, they hid away the baby, but they could no longer do it. Now, isn't it interesting here that they didn't say at this point, we better run, we better hide? It's interesting here to see how they complied in part. Did you notice that? Right? They made an ark, and they made it waterproof, and they put their baby in there, and they cast their baby into the river, right? With a few minor modifications along the way, right? But this is an incredible act, not only of compliance, but also an incredible act of faith. Because what they're saying is this, is we will not be the ones that immediately cause the death of our child. Instead, we're going to give our child the chance and let God do something. That's an incredible statement, right? They could have been like, there's no way we're going to hide our child somehow. But they did actually, at this point, comply with the command of Pharaoh by making a basket, putting him in the water. Again, with their modifications along the way, right? And the story is just beautiful how God works this all out. Pharaoh's daughter finds the baby. He starts crying, oh man, I wish somebody should nurse this baby. And Miriam, Moses' sister's right there like, I know a lady, I can find a lady. So Jochebed, Moses' mom, ends up getting to be the one that gets paid to nurse her own baby. It's beautiful. But it was disobedience, wasn't it? But this is one of those lines where the line was drawn, where they said, we are willing to put our baby into this ark that we made and to put him into the river as the government commanded to us, but we're doing this not causing the death, trusting that God's going to do something. But all of this was their own act of defiance against what Pharaoh had ordered, because what God wanted was better than what Pharaoh wanted. But still, like, there's a lot for us to ponder here as parents, to think about to the level at which they complied and the level at which they handed this over to God in faith. This is another instance where they complied as much as was possible, but had a greater devotion to God, and God rewarded their faith. But this is no simple choice. This whole scene is marked by faith in God and not by a fear of man. And that's what the whole topic of this whole series or this whole verse study is about, is do we fear God more or do we fear men more? You read in the book of Hebrews that they were obedient by putting the baby into the water because they feared God and not men. Read there about their testimony. They trusted that God would do what was right. It's interesting to ponder. Jump forward with me to 1 Samuel. Second example here that I want to show you is a people in arms. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 14 with me. Here's an instance with King Saul. And the backdrop of the story is, because of time, I'll just have to summarize for you, is Jonathan won a mighty victory, and he was hungry along the way, and he ate some honey. And everyone's like, oh no. He just fought, though. And the backdrop of this is that Saul is early in his reign. He's already offered unlawful sacrifice, but he hasn't yet spared Agag. He hasn't yet seen the witch. He hasn't had the Spirit of God removed from him yet. But this is what happens. 1 Samuel chapter 14 and verse 36. Saul said, let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. Let us not leave any of them. And they said, do whatever seems good to you. The priest said, let us draw near to God here. So Saul asked counsel of God, shall I go down after the Philistines? We will deliver them into the hands of Israel. But he did not answer him that day. And Saul said, come over here, you chiefs of the people, and know and see what sin was here today. For as the Lord lives, he who saves Israel, thought to be Jonathan my son, he will surely die. But not a man among the people answered him. Then he said to all of Israel, you be on one side and my son Jonathan and I will be on the other. People said to Saul, do what seems good to you. Therefore Saul said to the Lord God of Israel, give a perfect lot. So Saul and Jonathan were taken, and the people escaped. And Saul said, cast lots between Jonathan and me. And Jonathan was taken. And Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you've done. Jonathan said to him, I tasted a little honey with the end of a rod that was in my hand, so now I must die. And Saul answered and said, God do so and more also, for you will die, Jonathan. Then the people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Certainly not. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Here's the situation. Saul said, anybody eats, I'm going to kill him. And God didn't give them permission to go out and to raid the Philistines at night, and Saul said, there must be sin in the camp. So they rolled dice. They cast lots. Put the people on one side, Saul and Jonathan on the other side. The people were escaped. The sin wasn't with them. Then Saul and Jonathan are standing over there, and they're picked. And then the lot gets tasked between the two of them, and Jonathan is the one who is chosen. And Saul's going to kill his own son for this, because he dipped the rod into some honey so he could continue going on. And everybody knew, who's watching this, God was with Jonathan on the day when he had victory. God was with him and strengthening him through the little bit of honey that he had. Saul, what in the world are you doing? And rather than saying, Saul is our king, Saul has been given to us by God, Saul has the Spirit of God in him, what did the people do? They said, no way, we will not let this happen. Soldiers disobeying their king. And so they rescued Jonathan, and they took them out of that situation, right? They stood against the order of the king. And this is one of those things where we're reminded that the choice to stand for life, the choice to obey rather than to obey the government, is one of those things that does have to happen from time to time. These men disobeyed a God-ordained man in order to show fidelity and faithfulness to God. I'll just remind you, soldiers always have a choice. It might not be an easy choice. There may be severe consequences for soldiers disobeying their commanding officers, but soldiers have a choice. These soldiers stood against their king, their commander-in-chief, if you want to call it that, and they rescued Jonathan because what Jonathan did was right, and this was a good thing that they did. Now, a couple of examples in Babylon. Look over to Daniel with me. Look in Daniel chapter 1. We'll start there. Babylon and the examples that happen here are interesting because of the parallels to us living in a Babylon-type world today. I hope you know the book of Daniel is relevant not just because of the prophecy in the second half of the book. How to be men and women of courage and faith. And the first half of the book is just as relevant today because we live in a world that is pagan and seeking to indoctrinate us, just like it did to these young men that were living in this place. Daniel chapter 1, let's look at the first example here of how they said we must obey God rather than man. And notice again, how did they comply and how did they draw the line? And where were those lines drawn? Daniel chapter 1, verse 8. Daniel purposed in his heart he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now, God had brought Daniel into favor and the goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. The chief of the eunuchs said, I fear the Lord my king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than all the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then our appearance be examined before you and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies as you see fit, and so deal with your servants. So he consented with them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away the portions of the delicacies and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all dreams and visions. And it goes on there to talk about the positions that they were given. These men here said from the very beginning, we will not defile ourselves. And this is risky. Very risky. Why? Because what they're essentially saying is they have been taken as slaves of privilege, essentially. Right? They're the smart ones. They're the good-looking ones. They're the ones of high pedigree. And they were brought into the Babylonian kingdom so they could be indoctrinated and used as rulers in the nation. So they were privileged slaves. But for a slave to stand up and say, I don't want to eat that. I don't want to drink that. So it puts them in a very precarious situation. But they had already purposed in their heart that they would not defile themselves. However, notice, like Moses' parents, they were compliant to a certain degree. They were compliant to a certain degree. Some areas they were willing to bend in, like we'll find out later, they allowed their names to be changed. We find out they allowed themselves to live in residence among the pagans. We find out that they learned new languages and new cultural texts, and they actually excelled in wisdom and understanding, like we just read about. They allowed themselves to be a part to a certain degree, but there were some places where they're like, no more. And one of those places was food and drink. Now, to you and me, that might seem like, what's the big deal? Eat the food, drink the drink, right? It goes in one way and out the other. What's the big deal? But for them, this was a matter of defilement. Not only because of what the law of God commanded them, what they should eat and what they should not eat, and what they should drink and what they should not drink, but more importantly, understand all the food that came to the king's table had been offered to idols. To them, this was tantamount. This was the equivalent of saying, we are participating in the worship of idols. And that's why they wouldn't defile themselves. Yes, there were dietary laws that God spoke in his law. That's part of their cultural heritage that God gave to them in their law. But even more than that is they would not partake in this idolatry. The New Testament has a lot to say about these kinds of matters of food and things offered to idols because it was a major issue amongst Jews and Gentiles and the conversion that was happening and taking place. But the conclusion is very similar to the one that is reached here. You must act in good conscience before God. Paul would say very clearly that idols don't actually exist. You can read about that in Corinthians. But if you have a conviction about the food, then don't. Eat it. And be careful about how you eat around the people that are around you. But the whole goal is that our reasonableness would be known to people around us. And that is what you see here. These men said, we will not defile ourselves in this way. This is where we draw the line. This is one of those areas where we will not participate in this. But you notice here their reasonableness and how they're willing to comply. They make a request. Could we have 10 days as a trial? Right? Could we have vegetables and water for this period of time? Could we just see how it goes? Right? Their reasonableness is here. It's not like, I don't want to eat that. That's gross. Right? They're not going to be like kids, like feeding it to the dog under the table or wrapping it up in a napkin and sticking it in their pocket and going someplace. Right? They go and they, with formality and with compassion and with grace, they ask, could we try something different here for a period of time? And let's have a test. And at the end of the 10 days, if we fail, then you can do what you want to do. Right? And so you see here their willingness to offer an alternative. And of course, God blessed them because of their conviction. This is a principle for our age too. It's actually from Philippians chapter 4, verse 5. We should let our reasonableness be made known to all people, not our irritability and our grouchiness. Anybody agree wholeheartedly with everything the government does right now? I don't think so. If you do, then let's talk afterwards, right? But understand that we don't have to agree, but we do need to be reasonable. And that is part of the spirit and the savor of Christ that's supposed to be in us, is that our reasonableness is supposed to be known in us and seen, rather than our grouchiness and our irritability about everything, even if you disagree, and you're allowed to do that. But understand, the demeanor that's supposed to be demonstrated by the people of God is supposed to be different than the demeanor of those that are in the world that disagree in those contexts. Another example that's very powerful is a couple chapters over in chapter 3. Look over there with me. This is one, again, that's been known since Sunday school days, but maybe it's not familiar to you, or maybe you haven't read it in a while. But this is an instance where the three young men, not Daniel, he's someplace else doing something else, and these three men are asked to bow down and worship an idol. And so this is what happens. Chapter 3, and I'll start reading in verse 10. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, and the psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music will fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship will be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, their names have been changed. They complied to this point. These men, O king, you have not paid regard. These men, O king, have not paid regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image that you have set up. Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and in fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they brought these men before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar spoke to them, saying, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you did not serve my gods or worship the gold image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, the symphony, and all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you will be cast immediately into the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Show me, right? Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. And you know what happens from there. They threw him in the fire. The people that threw him into the fire was so hot it killed the soldiers. These guys went in. They didn't smell like smoke. They weren't singed. Nothing happened, and somebody else is there in the fire with them. One like the Son of Man. But what I want you to notice here is their statement specifically in verse 16 and 17 and 18. They draw the line at the false worship that they are being forced to participate in. They knew one thing for sure, that either God was going to rescue them or God was going to allow them to die. But what they knew for sure in their own hearts is, we won't bow. And this is an incredibly mature statement of their belief, because their belief is not dependent on if God delivers them or does not deliver them. They are already settled in their minds that we will not bow down. This is the kind of convictions that we're talking about. Not the matters of opinion, not the things that are an inconvenience to us or that increase our tax load. That's not the kind of stuff we're talking about. We're talking about, what will you die for? These men said here before the king with great boldness and with great eloquence that they would not bow down. Now, one of the things I just want to recognize along the way here is that all the instances I've shared so far, God always delivers them. But you just need to know God doesn't always deliver people from the fire. Starting next week, probably, Lord willing, we're going to talk about Stephen. Stephen is faithful to death. Right? God doesn't deliver him from the stones. God delivers him right to glory. So here's one of the things I want you to know is that if you choose to disobey, don't be like, well, Daniel, he doesn't get messed up with the food, strengthens him. These guys that get thrown in the fire, God doesn't hurt them. Daniel, I'm going to skip that example for the sake of time. Daniel gets thrown into a den of lions. The lions don't hurt him, so I'm invincible, right? Just have a little bit of sobriety about the whole thing. God doesn't always work it out just like this. The reason I pick these examples is not because you can go marching in front of firing squads hoping to survive, but because you need to know where you comply and where you draw the line. For these guys, they would not bow down. They knew in their hearts, verse 17, that God is able to deliver them even from the burning fiery furnace and from the hand of the king. Like, that's no big deal for our God. But even if he doesn't, verse 18, we won't bow down. That's where they drew the line. That is where they drew the line. The real question that comes here again that we must continue pondering is this, is where must we draw the line between how far we can go and comply with the government that God has put over us and the human institutions that he has placed without being disobedient to God. And these are the things that we have to continue to ponder. These are the questions that we have to pray about and fast over and search God's words to know how is it that we are to act in a world right now that is growing and increasingly antagonistic to the things that God loves and the things that God says is good. These are the kinds of questions that we're going to have to think upon and wrestle through. Another example I'm just going to mention briefly here, I guess by means of closing, is the one of Daniel. I'm not going to read it, but if you want to write down the verses that are up there, Daniel 6, 10 through 16, and 20 through 23, I think this is a relevant one for us to ponder here before we close. That is this. The summary of this is there was a scheme to get rid of Daniel, and they knew Daniel was a man of prayer. So he prayed all the time, facing towards Jerusalem, prayed. And so they made up this decree that if anybody prays to anybody other than the king of Persia at this point, then they're going to be thrown into a den of lions. And of course, Daniel, the text says, he knew that the edict had been signed, and he went and prayed. Now, the reason I bring this up and the reason I think it's worth stopping here for this morning is this, is Daniel could have simply just sat down on his bed and closed his eyes and prayed without anybody knowing, right? Daniel could have, you know, prayed with his eyes open, like we often do sometimes if we're driving, right? I recommend praying in your car, but I recommend keeping your eyes open, right? Why didn't Daniel just do that? Why did Daniel have to go to his window and face and pray towards the city? Well, for Daniel, he knew that he was innocent in the eyes of God. And that's actually what he declares to Darius after he's rescued out of the den of lions, is God has proven that he is innocent, so that everybody who's looking. Daniel knew what he's doing was right. But here's one of those things where we also have to think carefully about how do we apply this principle prudently. Something that I pondered a lot, something that our board pondered, something that you maybe wondered and pondered about too, is what if the government told us we're not allowed to meet in this building anymore? Would we? That's a thing for us to consider, right? I would remind you that we don't need a building, actually, to be the church. We have a beautiful testimony today of Christians that are in Myanmar, and there's a reason that she didn't share the pastor's name, because it's a